Well, it's Friday. Welcome to What Matters in North Carolina. So glad to have you listening to the program today. My name is Mark Shiver, and we are excited because we've got a really jam-packed show for you today. We'll be talking about an article called The Misplaced Rage in Charlotte, and also price gouging. And we'll follow up with a great rewind of a segment we recorded a couple of weeks ago with Francis DeLuca, president of the Civitas Institute, about property rights. So jam-packed today, and so glad to have you listening. Want to remind you, of course, that you need to tell your friends and family about What Matters in North Carolina, the Freedom Action Network, all of the great shows that we have there, NC Gundad, Free to Brew, and let them know, freedomactionnetwork.com. Also, you can find What Matters in North Carolina in the iTunes and Google Play stores. Have the podcast dropped right into your phone every day, or into your RSS feed, or whatever all of that high-tech stuff is called. But anyway, thank you so much for listening. You can connect with us on Twitter at What Matters NC, and we'd love to engage with you on Facebook, also What Matters in North Carolina. So buckle up. We've got a great show for you today, and we're going to dive right in talking about the misplaced rage in Charlotte here on What Matters in North Carolina. It's always a pleasure to welcome back to What Matters in North Carolina Hans von Spakovsky, his legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation, and certainly one of our favorite guests here on the program. Hans, welcome back.
Well, thanks for having me back.
Reading a piece that you have posted at nationalinterest.org entitled The Misplaced Rage in Charlotte, and took some guts to write a piece with that title.
Well, yeah, but I was really shocked at what was going on in the city, and I realized that what had started protests and turned into looting and throwing bottles and other things at police officers and others was a sign of how the narrative being pushed out there by the Black Lives Matter movement, by the media and others, is just completely and totally wrong. The idea that police officers are all biased, that they're all trying to go after Black Americans. I mean, all of that is a myth, and it's just not true.
Well, Hans, the reality is that the media feeds off of this. They love this kind of stuff. It gets eyeballs. And, of course, I think also a part of the overall leftist agenda is to be able to flame this as much as possible. But interestingly enough, there was a Caucasian gentleman, I think, over the weekend shot in Washington State. And I haven't seen a word about that anywhere, shot by a policeman. So the selective coverage, I think, by the media doesn't help in trying to calm these situations.
Oh, no, that's absolutely true. And, you know, I think it would have been difficult for most people watching the news or reading news accounts of what happened in Charlotte. They wouldn't realize that, in fact, the Black resident of Charlotte who was killed, Keith Lamont Scott, was actually killed by a Black police officer, not a white police officer. And the police department in the city is headed by a Black police chief. And yet you had protesters out there, including, by the way, Mr. Scott's brother, who was caught on video calling white people, well, I can't use the language on the radio, devils, and saying white cops are devils. And, no one wants to acknowledge the fact that the evidence is simply not there to support the thesis of the Black Lives Matter movement. In fact, it is an unfortunate fact that we all have to face that young Black males commit crimes at much higher rates than other Americans of all races. And that's one of the reasons why, for example, police often have a greater presence in poor Black urban neighborhoods, which these activists are complaining about, but it's because that's where the crime is. And who are the victims of that crime? Law-abiding, poor urban Blacks.
Well, yeah, I've found myself listening. For some reason, Hans, sports radio has latched on to all of this, I guess because of NFL football players who are refusing to stand for the national anthem or taking a knee in protest of what they describe as injustice toward the African-American community. And I feel like calling into some of these sports talk shows sometimes and saying, you know, you guys are being thoroughly hypocritical, because if you really cared about African Americans, you wouldn't just be talking about football players, you know, not standing during the national anthem, but you'd be talking about the fact that there's a 70-something percent fatherlessness rate in the black community, that black-on-black crime is rampant. And these are things that are much more serious issues to the African-American community, and yet, you know, they don't push the needle.
Right. And in fact, look, if you look at the actual hard data, and I'm talking about data that's put out by the U.S. Justice Department. You know, they have a bureau that puts out and collects data on criminals and convictions across the country. And look, they've put out data that has shown that, for example, look, the number of black Americans who are killed by police officers, first of all, is a very small percentage, and it is not out of proportion, unfortunately, to the rate at which they engage in crime. And in fact, a much higher percentage of police officers are unfortunately killed by black defendants. It's a much greater rate than, for example, the rate of black Americans in the general population. So you know, these law enforcement officers are risking their lives every day to try to protect folks no matter what their race or ethnicity, and the general attacks on them are just wrong.
Yeah, well, and our guest is Hans von Spakovsky, an excellent legal mind from the Heritage Foundation, and we're discussing a piece that he has up at nationalinterest.org. I would encourage you to read. The title is called The Misplaced Rage in Charlotte. Now, Hans, obviously one incident or two and the response to those incidents is not going to address the systemic problems, whether it's in the African-American community or in our society as a whole. But certainly, people throwing bottles and looting stores and attacking innocent people in a parking garage, those are not the kinds of behaviors that is really going to promote any kind of dialogue of change.
Well, no. In fact, it does the exact opposite, because what does it do? When folks see on the news videos of black protesters looting a Walmart store and beating up just a white person who happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, what does that do? It unfortunately confirms the ideas that folks may have about certain segments of the community, and that's not a good idea either.
Yeah, it certainly reinforces many preconceived notions that some people may have, and that certainly, as you said, is unfortunate and doesn't do anything really to help. But I'm wondering, and I know that you have limited time today, and I want to respect that, but what do we do, Hans? I mean, and let me before you answer that, let me just say this. I believe that most African Americans who are in this country are just like everybody else. They're working, they're trying to provide for their families, they want what's best for their kids. But it seems like the demographic has been taken hold of by those who want to promote and foment racism, and they do it at the expense of the black community. I thought what Donald Trump said in Michigan was outstanding. What have you got to lose? You've been voting Democrat for the last Lord knows how many years, and it hasn't helped. So this cycle seems to continue where racist leaders foment racism, which I don't think most of the black community wants anyway. You know, they want to be successful in America and enjoy opportunity like everybody else. But how do we stop this cycle?
Well, that's going to be difficult. Things have gotten worse under the current president, and that's because he has made it very clear that he divides Americans up into groups. His political party, unfortunately, thinks that making people divide themselves into racial groups helps them at the elective office. And we need a president who actually comes out and says, look, I want Americans to come together We are not going to divide people up according to their, you know, racial or cultural identity, because we're all Americans. And you're not getting that from him. You're also not getting it from the Justice Department. For example, the head of the Civil Rights Division, a woman named Vinita Gupta, who's been going around giving speeches saying that, all of American society is systemically racist, and we all suffer from implicit bias. All, you know, all these claims that are just simply not true.
Yeah, and at the same time, the Civil Rights Commission last week came out with the really intelligent decision or assumption that religious liberty is nothing but code for racism, homophobia, Islamophobia, Martin Castro making that brilliant deduction. And I think that you're right, absolutely, Hans, that this administration has done nothing in the way of trying to bring America together, to bring a sense of unity, of common good, but in fact has done exactly the opposite. And many, by the way, have asserted that he's really done nothing for the black community.
Well, he hasn't. I mean, the unemployment today is higher than it's ever been. The crime problems, particularly because of this attack on law enforcement, a lot of it engineered by the Justice Department, crime has gone up for the first time in decades. The murder rate has started climbing again in some of the major cities. That's the direct result of the depolicing being pushed by these protesters and now by the U.S. Justice Department.
Yeah, it's really a situation that doesn't have any easy answers. Well, Hans, we appreciate your availability and your willingness to talk about this subject. And thank you always for being our guest on What Matters in North Carolina.
Sure, call me anytime.
Great, thank you, sir. Well, it's been a while since we have talked with Greg Poulter here on What Matters in North Carolina. As you know, he does the very popular Free to Brew podcast, which you can listen to here on the Freedom Action Network. And Greg, welcome back to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
Well, I wanted to chat you up a little bit because we've been talking here on the program in the last few days or so about helping people and how conservatives have gotten kind of a bad rap as mean-spirited, and they don't really give back to the community. We had a guy on the show yesterday, owns a bunch of Planet Fitness franchise or locations, and he's taking some of the money that he's making from his business and putting into a program where kids will have an opportunity to learn things that have to do with STEM, science and technology and math and all that kind of stuff. And these after-school programs that are really, really cool, teaching them how to program and do 3D printing and all this kind of stuff.
That's great.
Just an example of somebody who is engaging in capitalism and giving back to the community. And so you've written a piece at a website called
Opportunity Lives.com.
I don't know if it was lives or not. OpportunityLives.com. And you were telling me that that's kind of their goal, too, is to, well, you tell me.
Yeah, a lot of the articles that they put out there is showing how the individual and giving more access to individual rights and liberties can promote the poorest out there and help them get out of their situation and onto better lives.
Well, I think that's something that really conservatives have not done a very good job of getting that message out, because so often, Greg, the narrative is that poor people need to rely on the government, that they need government programs and government assistance and government help. And you don't typically think about free markets and capitalism and that sort of thing as being the vehicle wherein people who are, you know, struggling, whether it's in economically or otherwise, we don't really think of that being where we go for help.
Yeah, and there's a recent article that I wrote on is price gouging in particular, and I would agree with you that it's a very difficult idea to get across, in that if you're allowing the markets to actually fluctuate and put value where the consumer and those who need it most can have access to the goods and services that are out there, you can actually help the most people. And to me, I think it's the most moral system is capitalism, to make sure that the limited amount of resources that we have on this earth at any the given time can go to where it is actually needed, and not according to some arbitrary or government regulation that has no idea what the people actually need and want. And the latest article that I wrote about was on price gouging. And recently, a lot of people in the South and North Carolina, in particular, were affected by empty pumps. Mark, I don't know about you, but I went through 5 gas the stations this last week, just to find a station that had gas at it. Everywhere was empty. There was no gas, but at every station, it was the regular $2.15 a gallon. There was no increase or anything. And but we all knew about this pipeline burst. So
right.
That would mean that as far as an entrepreneur, as far as a consumer, like, you know, there's going to be a shortage up ahead.
Right.
So if the prices are going to remain the same, there's going to be a huge mad dash to get as much as you can,
right?
Because you're not really sure how long this thing is going to last for. But had the entrepreneurs, the gas station owners and the companies been allowed to price this accordingly, as to know there's going to be a shortage. And I sort of bring up in the article that there's a shortage technically of everything at any given time. But the thing is, in instances like this, it's just a shock to the system that we see. And
right.
But they knew that it was coming. So had they have increased the price of gas, granted, you would be paying more at the pump, but it would have changed a lot of people's spending habits, in that they would make sure that if someone was just going to drive around the block a couple of times, or just go to the store to get some groceries, or just go on vacation, they would have changed their habits at that moment to reflect the higher price of gas. And my argument is that having the price being raised, there would have been access to gas, and we would not have had a shortage.
We would not have had a shortage.
Well, and by that, what I mean in the shortage is, like, the pumps were dry.
Right.
But had the price gone up, there would have been gas left at the pump. And the reason why that's a good thing and not an empty gas station is that, take for instance, in Venezuela, they have shortages everywhere because the government mandates a cap on prices. You can't raise the price of any goods and services. And that's why you see these jokes about them running out of toilet paper and running out of some supplies. But that trickles out of control. And suddenly you're running out of gas, you're running out of food, you're running out of just daily needs that we take for granted here in the United States. And what we had in North Carolina and the South was a microcosm of those issues. And that McCrory, I believe, he instituted the anti-price gouging hotline, I believe, where you could call in and let people know, or the government know, if you thought that someone was gouging prices out there.
Right.
But the thing was, if you were allowed to increase the price, someone who, like myself, I was on empty, I needed to get to work in the morning. If the price had gone up with my tank on empty, that $2.15 gas was worth far more to me than $2.15.
Right.
At that point, not knowing if I was going to be able to get home or not, I was willing to pay $10 for 1 gallon just to make sure I could get home.
Right.
And going into work the next day, had I spent $5, $10 a gallon on 2 gallons of gas or 3 gallons of gas just to make sure I had a round trip, I was still going to make more at work than what that gas cost me. And for someone who is just trying to pay rent or trying to just pay the bills, trying to put food on the table, that can mean a difference of having a job and being out of work because there was no gas available. Even though if the price were allowed to increase, they could still have access to that gas, and they would still be able to make income and make a living, even though at that time it would have been a bit inconvenient with the prices.
Well, that's certainly supply and demand at its most extreme, what you're outlining. The demand is so great that prices are going to naturally grow go up. And so I can follow you, follow along and understand what you're saying. But in terms of human behavior, gouging is thought of, Greg, as business owners not necessarily reacting to supply and demand, but taking advantage of other people, you know, sticking it to them. That's what gouging means. You know, you guys need gas, so you're screwed. I can charge you whatever I want. And there is a stigma associated with that. So it's not really, in its purest form, supply and demand, but it's also supply and demand with possibly, you know, a motive on the part of the gas station owner or the supplier, you know what I mean, to really take advantage of people.
And that's the feel-good effect of why these laws were put into place, that we're protecting the consumer from these evil owners that are trying to charge more than what they should. Well, at the end of the day, you as a consumer can pick and choose where you shop. And at this given moment in time, the value of that gas was far higher to a lot of people than it was to many others, such as someone that was just who needed to go to the store to pick up something that they forgot, or right. they were just going to drive around town, or they were actually buying gas for next week right. and not for this current time when we have this shortage or this limited supply, and thereby creating the shortage. So I understand that people think that price gouging is a bad thing, and of itself, the term, yes, it is. If you're going to arbitrarily charge more than what the actual value of the gasoline is worth. But the thing is, that's a very subjective idea.
Right.
And if someone is charging 10 bucks a gallon, you have the ability to drive around to other gas stations. You have the ability to decide, is this this gallon of gas worth it? And as far as in the market it was this other week, potentially this could have gone on longer. Potentially yeah. this could have not been, or this could have been an issue where this lasted 2 weeks or three weeks. But by raising that price, so let's just say we have this arbitrary owner that decides everyone else is at $2.15, but I'm going to charge 10 bucks. I'm going to try to get as much money as possible because right. I'm going to take advantage of them. The thing is, at that moment, with all the technology that we have, you can shop around. You could also, and if you do decide to shop there, you buy the 10 bucks in gas, you're probably not ever going to shop there again if you see that they're the ones that are gouging
right.
and they're not doing this effectively. But at the same time, if they're raising the price because they see that others are without gas and that they're the only ones left, they have to figure out the price at which the people who need it the most, who value that gas the most, get it. And on top of that, if you're allowed to increase the price of gas, there's going to be a cap really on the market, especially in these areas of crisis, mm-hmm. Such as during a hurricane or during floods or just during the shortage that we had, where suddenly it now becomes cost effective for competitors and anyone that's trying to bring their product into the market for them to come to these areas of need right. and these areas where they don't have anything. So take for instance, if we were isolated here and there's one gas station left or they're charging 10 bucks a gallon, suddenly there's probably going to be some people across in other states, in other cities, in other areas that have excess gas. But they need to make up for the cost of transportation. They need to make up for paying a guy to bring it down there. By allowing them to increase their price, that need is going to be fulfilled as efficiently as possible, so that okay. the most gas can come to this area, according to everyone else. And the thing is, like, without these arbitrary laws, that's where we see the government stepping in, capping how much the gas can be for fear of this vague number that no one knows what is actually gouging or not. But according to the market, you would see competition, you would see people bringing value into the state and bringing more gas to the customers that need it. And a point that I really wanted to make was, what if were now out of gas because no one could raise prices. It was arbitrarily way too low in the market than what the value that people actually had on it. In my scenario, I was just trying to get to work.
Right.
But there could be an elderly couple that needs to get to the hospital.
Okay.
Or a pregnant woman that needs to get to the hospital as well. There could be a number of crises that all they need is just that gallon of gas, and that gallon is worth basically life or death at that point. And because we have these caps on prices, that's where we run into, because I don't want someone to pay more than nobody gets it. So they would rather see that nobody has access to gas than there actually be access available at any given point for the emergencies in our lives.
Well, I certainly understand the point that you're making, and I think it's well thought out, and you've articulated it very well. The only problem that I can see is that there is no competition really in the gasoline delivery system that we have in this country. There are just a few suppliers, you know, large companies, and there may be, you know, mom and pop stores out in the country that sell gas, but still they're getting their gas likely from one of three or four large suppliers. And so it's not like you or I could go out and say, hey, let's sell gas.
Well, and I would like to challenge that. I mean, as someone, as like, there are farmers out there that keep an excess supply. They have small supplies because they load up on their trucks and whatnot and their own storage tanks. Why should they not be able to be incentivized to go out into a marketplace and resell the gas that they had accumulated for a rainy day or accumulated for spending in a month as to what they actually can make a better profit on today? So you would actually see people coming out of the woodwork that would actually come into the marketplace and help out, but be able to recoup the costs of them having to do that. And I completely understand that people would think that there's these large companies out there, but they abide by the same supply-demand curves as everybody else, even in a crisis as it is on a rainy day. And like I said at the beginning, there is a limited supply of gas on this planet at any given moment.
Right.
That's why we see gas prices have gone up over the years. We see sometimes I was in Colorado. It was $5 a gallon during the peak of the crisis that we had with all the gas rising in prices as far as oil is concerned. And so were they price gouging at that point? Because they were charging $5 a gallon, and I really didn't want to pay it. But just down the road, they were only charging four if I would have driven 50 miles, or they were only charging $3 if I would have driven another 100.
Right.
So why is that not considered price gouging there in a system where there's billions of gallons of oil everywhere in the world and billions of gallons of gas, but this area doesn't have that type of supply and doesn't have that type of demand, so they have to raise the price? So we're just looking at these crisis situations in which we think that, oh no, this is the time that they need it. Exactly. This is the time that the people who are in crisis need the gas, and they're not going to get it if it's only priced at $2.15 or under what the market values it at, and nobody gets gas except the lucky few who got there first.
Right.
Who don't value it like everybody else.
Well, there are four gas stations in the town where I live.
Mm-hmm.
They're always priced the same. There's no competition between prices. And they are typically 20 cents or more higher than 5 miles up the road.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't buy gas typically where I live.
Yeah.
And it aggravates me that they feel inclined to jam those of us that live in the town with higher prices, when you know the gas costs the same to deliver here on the street 5 miles away.
Or does it?
Well,
potentially it does, but the thing is, a gas station is not only typically making their profits on gas, they're also making it from the goods that you're buying in the store as well.
Right.
The sodas, the snacks, anything else that's in there, or if it's a garage, you're making on that.
Right.
So that's why you see typically like garages, that's all they have. They're price of gas a little higher because they're just making it on the garage. But on gas state or the stations that need the people to come, the areas where you're probably saying where there's four in town,
right,
priced higher, they're not getting a lot of traffic over there with everyone else. And the thing is, they're taking the risk that if they're going to charge more, they're risking that you're never stopping there.
Right.
You're going somewhere else because at that point they've priced it too high to get your business because there is an easy, accessible alternative somewhere else.
Yeah, and it ticks me off. I'd like to support my hometown business, but you know, I feel like they feel like, hey, you know, we're just going to screw people here in town because we can. You know, they know that most people, out of convenience, will buy their gas in town.
And you're paying the convenience.
Right. Well, I'm not. But
exactly,
somebody
because
else is.
Your time is worth more elsewhere.
Yeah. So, well, it's a fascinating topic, supply and demand and free markets. And in fact, on Monday, our entire show is going to be devoted to this very thing. So thank you for teeing us up for for what's to come on Monday. Greg Pulcher, the great Free to Brew show here on the Freedom Action Network. And we appreciate your time today and talking about the economy and supply and demand and all that good stuff.
Mark, thank you.
Thanks, Greg. Well, today we've been talking about property rights, private property, an important part of our country's foundation. In fact, Thomas Jefferson said in 1816, the true foundation of Republican government is the equal right of every citizen in his person and property and in their management. Joining us now to talk about this and how important property rights are in 2016, Francis DeLuca, president of the Civitas Institute. Francis, welcome back to What Matters in North Carolina.
Mark, good to be with you. And this is an important topic. Property rights is an important topic.
Well, it certainly is something that we've heard a lot about of in the news recently. In fact, we just had Congressman Mark Meadows on the show talking about the Tennessee Valley Authority trying to run people out of their floating homes, which they've been living on Lake Fontana and in Tennessee on Norris Lake for decades. And now suddenly the TVA doesn't want them there anymore, and they're giving them time to pack up and move out. But this is just an example of people who own property and a quasi-governmental agency coming in and trying to displace them, and it just doesn't seem right.
Well, it's kind of these arbitrary decisions to, you know, do things like that. And so, you know, I'm not too familiar with the TVA thing, you know, but if the, you know, if at some point in the past they had to allow that, they didn't just do it, they didn't squat on the lake.
Right.
So they had to allow them, and, you know, people have invested money and everything. And really what this gets back to, and Thomas Jefferson and our founding fathers, part of the reason our country was established was because of arbitrary things like taxes that were being imposed without the consent of the governed, that would be the American colonist.
Right.
You know, about when the British would house people in, put troops in houses. That was about taking a property. That was about using your, you know, your house as a basically as a barracks,
right,
without compensating you or without asking your permission. You know, other things where they would take stuff from people and confiscate things. And so, you know, up to this time, in even in England, they couldn't do some of those things. So, but over time, the ideal of private property has emerged, and it's become kind of fundamentally linked to freedom. And the reason is because, you know, in the feudal days, in the days in some parts of the world, the government through the king or queen and, you know, the royalty, they could just do anything they wanted. They could go and they could go, Mark, we like your house. We're taking it. Thank you. So without that concept of private property, there really isn't freedom, because part of freedom is to, you know, own things and to have the ability to provide for yourself. So if you have like a horse or a mule and you're tilling your land, and the king or the duke or the earl comes by and says, Mark, fine looking donkey there, I'm taking it with me. Suddenly you can't till your land.
That's
you no longer have the freedom to feed your family or to earn a living. You know, now you can indenture yourself to somebody else, or you can go steal, or you can go beg, or you maybe get a job, but the freedom you had was gone. So that's why when we talk about property rights, how important they really are. And that is one of the things it's been the center of a lot of the different arguments. And even today, when we talk about things like taxes and everything, we are talking about property rights. Taxes are a governmental taking of stuff. And we have agreed that, you know, we've kind of come to an agreement that some taxes are necessary and that the government has a right to tax to provide for the common good and defense and things like that. The question is, where is the appropriate level of taxation has always been one of the, kind of central arguments in our political thing. But also, you know, you have to acknowledge that the only way government gets their taxes is at the point of a gun.
Yeah.
People don't like that kind of imagery, but it's true. Nobody really voluntarily pays taxes. They know there's a threat from the government to pay them. Now, some people more or less voluntarily, like I have no problem filling out my taxes. I don't like doing it every year, but I do it. And nobody has to hold a gun to my head.
Right.
There's other people who have a little more problem with that, and they don't want to pay taxes, and they feel the government has no right to collect it. But now, like I said, we've come to a point where that isn't where we are. We are that taxes are a legitimate action of government. But, you know, this goes back to property. You know, in terms of keeping your property, the people in the lake, you know, we have the things out west where ranchers are not allowed to graze anymore because the Bureau of Land Management has decided that that is not a suitable use of a land. So
exactly.
we're going to take away grazing rights. Well, that was essentially property rights for people. They were existed because they could graze their animals there and then sell them. But suddenly when someone takes that away, it is in essence taking a property right from them. And one of the issues in North Carolina over the years, there have been a couple of issues that have to do with property rights that are fundamental. A good one a few years ago that was very hot, and when the Republicans took over, they really went after it pretty quickly, and that was forced annexation. Mm-hmm. That's where towns and cities would annex areas where the people didn't want to be annexed.
That's right.
But they would take it, and they would say it's necessary because these people are coming into town and using government services, therefore we need their taxes to support our government services. And the people's argument was, wait a minute, we moved here outside of town so that we didn't have to be in town. We don't have to subscribe to your water, sewer, trash collection, or pay your taxes. But now you want to take our land and basically take our property by making us pay taxes on the land we already own. And we get nothing, you give us something, but we don't want it. So in a sense, that's a property rights question. The whole idea of forced annexation is telling you what you can do with your property, because along with forced annexation come all kinds of city rules and everything in terms of how you use your property, all those things. So that was one example of a kind of a property rights issue that happened a few years ago and has been settled. Another one is eminent domain.
Boy, that's a big one.
It always has been a big one, and it flares up every once in a while. We saw the latest flare up here in North Carolina with the CSX hub that was originally going to locate in Johnson County.
That's right.
And the only way they could have done that was to use eminent domain to take some property that people did not want to willingly sell. And that's been a big point of contention as to what is appropriate eminent domain. Most people would agree that it is appropriate if the government uses eminent domain for things like water lines, sewer lines,
right.
Maybe even power lines. Today we can't exist without power, so allowing the power company to use eminent domains to locate power lines is a good that needs to happen, because most people are not going to put up their own power lines and everything. So
sure.
So and now the question is, does that extend to something like a train depot? Is that a common good? It used to be that, when the trains back in the 1800s were being expanded, they expanded using eminent domain. The government took land and gave it to the trains. They took thousands and thousands.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Hundreds of thousands of acres and gave it to the railroad companies. And that's because they wanted the trains built. So, that's a case of, kind of eminent domain. But what we saw more and more in the last 20, 30, 40 years was eminent domain being used. It was used up north in a lot of inner cities, some of the bigger cities in the south. They would go in and take areas of the city that they considered blighted, and they would take the area and then turn it over to somebody else, another
right.
commercial developer. In other words, it wasn't government taking it for a government good. It was government saying, we think this land has a higher and better use than what you're using it for now. Therefore, we're going to take it from you. We're going to pay you what we think we should pay you and what we can get a court to agree to. And then we're going to give it to Francis.
Yeah.
Because Francis wants to put a high-rise building on it, or Francis wants to put a casino on it, or Francis wants to put a shopping mall on
it.
But what ended up happening was Mark's single-family home there, he lost. And he, and even though he got paid, that may not be enough to buy him a home that is similarly useful to him. In other words, the price of housing is going up, so he is not going to get paid. He can't go buy another house and not have a mortgage on it.
One of the things, Francis, that I've been fascinated listening to you kind of break this down, because I want to go back to one of the very first things that you said, because I have to admit candidly that I had not thought about property rights in this way before, but it really is tied into liberty. I mean, if a government can come in and take your house or your land, then you're really not free. And that's a big, big difference between a conservative ideology that, that calls for smaller government and rare cases of government encroaching on private property, as opposed to a liberal ideology, which is more favorable to this type of an environment.
Absolutely right. And that's really, you know, as you told me about the topic today, and I said, so I kind of thought about it a little, and I said, we're really, you know, I didn't have to think long before the whole thing about that property rights are inextricably linked to personal freedom, because without property rights, you really have no personal freedom. Now, it literally, take the clothes off your back if people don't have personal property rights.
That's
because,
right.
You know, if I'm a government official, Mark, give me your clothes. Well, wait a minute. Those are my clothes. No, they aren't. They're our clothes.
Yeah. Wow.
And you know, people go, oh, you're being extreme. No, but there are cases where people have been treated like that. And there are a lot of countries in the world that still exist in that kind of thing, where people don't have their own personal property rights. I mean, if you look at one of the things about communist China, you know, about the communist China, is they don't really respect property rights. That's why we have such a hard time with intellectual property. They steal intellectual property from American companies all the time. Now, it's such a big market, a lot of American companies turn a blind eye to it, because they want to sell property. They want to sell things in the country. So they allow China to ignore the theft of intellectual property in return for being able to operate in China.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, you know, selling someone the hammer they're going to beat you on the head with. But it's kind of funny. But they are. They're closely linked.
Well, the framers of our Constitution and the Founding Fathers, just to kind of drive this point home, they really saw liberty and property as intertwined. One did not exist without the other. Jefferson and Monroe and others, you can do a Google search on their quotes about property rights, and I mean, it's page after page after page. This was something that they really saw as important. In fact, the Fifth Amendment talks about you can't take property without just compensation and process.
And that was a lot of, you know, that grew directly out of the revolution, because that was one of the reasons they rebelled against the rulers in England, because they were not respecting the property rights of the colonists. And, you know, and this goes, and like I said, this goes back to the whole ideal that, you know, if you don't own your own property, if you don't own your own things, you really can't truly be free, because you cannot be secure in what you have. And once that, once you're secure, you can build on what you have. You know, if you're a farmer, you can add acreage, because you know that you're going to have those 10 mules and those implements to work the fields.
Right.
You know, and you can, and when you harvest the grain, it's your grain, you know, that you can then sell. And that's why property rights are so important. Now, if you're a manufacturer and you manufacture something, you don't have to worry about the government coming in and say, oh, well, we need half of that so that we can sell it.
Yeah.
You know, and I say government because that's usually who it is. And government does not necessarily mean that, you know, the government like the U.S. A lot of places it means the dictator, the king, the whatever it might be, the ruling Politburo. You know, like I said, there are still exercises of that around the world. You know, Russia today, you know, it's kind of ruled by oligarch. And there's still a lot of things in Russia where the government comes in on behalf of other rich people and kind of forces sales of businesses to these other people. That is a place where property rights are not secure.
That's right.
You know, if you're forced to sell to somebody, then you really don't own what you have.
What do you think? One case that I think needs further explanation, and we had Dave Bremer of the Pacific Legal Foundation on last week to talk about this, and he did a really good job. But I think it bears repeating, Francis, our guest Francis DeLuca here on What Matters in North Carolina, president of the Civitas Institute, down in Emerald Isle. This is a perfect example. Now, here's some people that own some property, and it's actually part of the beach, and the town decided to take part of their property and make it part of a thoroughfare where they could drive their town maintenance vehicles and such across. They did not compensate them. They did not go through any kind of legal proceedings. The local newspapers painted this as a doomsday scenario where, oh my gosh, people aren't going to be able to lay out on the beach or walk in the sand, which is not true. These people that own this land, they just want what the Fifth Amendment says. There's a procedure and a just compensation.
Well, wanted to talk to that. This has been one of the most, you know, kind of, we at Civitas have gotten more kind of input, feedback, I'm being nice here, from people. We've gotten some positive stuff too. Some people have said, yes, we have a similar situation where the government's doing something to us that is similar to Emerald Isle. But to explain, you know, you explained it fairly well. What the town of Emerald Isle, and I'm not a lawyer on the case. I'm not a lawyer, period. But when we had a lawyer at Civitas who filed a brief in support of the Pacific Legal Foundation, and they're representing the homeowners in Emerald Isle. And in North Carolina, to give everybody kind of a full thing, as a beach owner, if you own an oceanfront home, you own to the high water mark of the beach. So in other words, you own from, you know, the property line in the on the mainland, on the land side, all the way to the high water mark on the ocean side.
Okay.
The highest where the water comes up to. You pay taxes on that. You theoretically own it. Now, we have some rules governing construction on the beach. You cannot build to the high water mark. You can only build from the vegetation line back. And in North Carolina, there's a whole complicated formula for where you can build on the land. So you already have some restrictions on your property rights. Yeah. But those are pretty much agreed on, and they are in the public.
People live with that.
They've been tested in court, and they're based on how they're good for the public at large. And it's not a unfair taking that you still have use of your property,
right?
But you have some things that protect other people too.
Okay.
So that said, what has happened, and you know, you go to the high water mark, and they're what's called dry sand. Mm-hmm. North Carolina has also had what's known as a public use doctrine for the beaches. And that's basically that the dry sand up to the line of vegetation is open to anybody to walk on. In other words, you cannot fence off your property down to the high water mark.
Okay.
So in front of the dune, people can walk back and forth. You know, you can walk in the water. You can, you know, walk in the dune. You know, we don't, you know, it is against the law to walk in the dunes and destroy the plants. I mean, that is a law that you know, so you don't have unfettered access to that. Even as a property owner, you know, you can only use that if you're doing some work or something like that.
Okay.
You know? So the town of Emerald Isle comes along and goes, well, we want to be able to run our emergency vehicles. So we're going to designate this strip of the beach. And again, I'm not a lawyer, so I'm kind of paraphrasing some of this. We're going to designate this strip of beach as a, basically a road.
All right.
And so the homeowners go, what? Yeah, well, we need to make sure that you don't put any objects in this area. You don't, we want to be able to run vehicles up and down here. And in some places, you can actually drive private vehicles on the beach. You know, a lot of North Carolina beaches allow private mm-hmm. vehicles at different times of the year.
Yeah, that's
but
true.
We want to keep this area clear. And, you know, and the homeowners went, well, that's fine. We think you should compensate us for taking our property because you're basically putting a road through our front yard. You know, that's our front yard. We pay taxes on it. According to the deed, we own it. So we're fine with you putting it through it, but we want compensation. Sure. And the town goes, heck no. You know, we have the public use doctrine says we can use it. And, you know, but this is a case where it's a government unit doing it, basically creating a thoroughfare through their yard without saying we're going to pay. It is not prohibiting the town from running an emergency vehicle across the beach to help somebody.
Right.
It's saying, but you can't just run vehicles up and down this for any reason, and you can't allow private vehicles, you can't designate this a roadway without compensating us. Well, when we filed the brief, we've had people just hollering because, again, part of legal things are not just legal, it's also public relations.
Right.
So, you know, of course, you know, the Pacific Legal Foundation and the owners and our brief would say, yes, this is a taking by the Constitution, and therefore those people need to be compensated. The other side said this is an attempt to end the public use doctrine to not allow people to walk on the dry sand beach in North Carolina, which is not what the case is doing.
Not at all.
And I don't believe any court in North Carolina or any federal court would go that far to ending North Carolina's historic dry sand use of the beach. You know, if we were going to end the dry sand use, the lawsuit would say you can't allow people to drive on the sand anytime.
Yeah.
But that's not what it's saying. And you know, so the people who are kind of reacting to this and saying, oh, you're a bunch of people from New Jersey trying to change our laws and you don't understand and we need to be able to walk on the beach anywhere we want. I think that's great. I do that. I walk on the beach all the time.
Sure.
When I go to the beach. I believe that is good. But I've also been to other places, not New Jersey, but like Florida, where they designate lanes on the beach for drivers. Guess what? You can't put things. You can't put a chair there. You can't put a blanket there. They, by doing this, are setting up the thing where the public access to the beach could be restricted because of the governmental access on the beach. In other words, if you build this thoroughfare, well, if it's a designated thing, they will come along and tell you to move your towel, move your chair, move your cooler, move your umbrella. I mean, they're not going to allow you to set up in it.
So
so they are going to deny access to the dry sand beach.
So the people who are concerned about this are saying that the homeowner is wrong in defending the town, and yet it's actually over time, if this is allowed to stand, the town could actually be the one that comes up and bites them and takes away their use of dry sand beach.
Well, on a high tide, and you've got a designated thoroughfare, and that may be the only strip of dry sand beach, and they're going, sorry, you got to move your plant. Well, where am I going to move it? Well, you may just have to get off the beach.
Yeah.
You know, because we have to keep this clear so we can go help somebody on the beach, you know, in case they're drowning or something. And that's, but I mean, that's kind of the, if you take things to their extreme,
right,
that's where you get to. But, you know, this is in no way an attempt to take away dry sand access. It is an attempt to kind of keep the government in check from violating our Constitution and doing an unlawful taking. And that's a hard thing to explain to people because all they hear is some property owners want to stop people from using the beach.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
That's a much easier thing to do. But the basic concept, this is where things get complicated. You know, this is where people's people's rights run into other people's expectations.
That's good. Just to kind of put a bow on this, what I was thinking as you were describing this is if this is allowed to stand in 15, 20 years, then because the law often evolves out of what has been going on for a decade or two, that thoroughfare might actually be recognized as something that belongs to the municipalities, and all of the homeowners along the beach are just going to be, you know, out of luck and not having been compensated.
Well, I don't think it's going to take 15 or 20 years. If they win this suit, it in fact today that will be happening.
Wow. So,
and it will allow other municipalities to do the same thing, and you'll see that a number of them will quickly.
One of the things, Francis, as we bring this to a close, that I think that bears talking about briefly is, you know, we're in this presidential election, and North Carolina is a hot spot. All of the candidates are coming, and all of their surrogates are coming.
Isn't it fun?
And it's wonderful. And certainly weekly, but almost daily, we've got somebody from some of the campaigns, or one of the campaigns coming. And people have talked about this election from the standpoint of a conservative versus a liberal future for our country. And thinking about this topic right here of private property and property rights and the way the Supreme Court would interpret the Fifth Amendment, this election is very important because the next president could be appointing justices to the Supreme Court.
Well, right now there's no could be.
Well, they will be appointing at least one.
At least one, and there's a chance of two to four justices.
Yeah.
I mean, we have a number of justices that are getting on up in years. So there will probably be several vacancies in the next term. And whoever the next appointee is, and then the next two or the three, really will set legal policy for, you know, decades, possibly hundreds of years to come.
So we think about First Amendment free speech and freedom of religion. We think about, you know, the Second Amendment folks, but we don't often hear about this topic right here and how the interpretation by the Supreme Court of the Fifth Amendment and government taking people's property. This is something that will definitely be something that to watch in the next.
Property rights are very important. In fact, a few years ago, the Supreme Court did a case called the Kelo case from Connecticut, where they allowed a town to take private property and give it to another private entity. And that went all the way to the Supreme Court by 5-4. And that the makeup of the court has changed since then, but we haven't had another court case get there. By 5-4, the court said, yes, you can do that. And there was a lot of outrage. And one of the things in North Carolina we've tried to do is get an amendment in our state court, our state constitution that says in North Carolina, you cannot do that. But unfortunately, even with supposedly a Republican conservative legislature, they don't want to do that because development interests are very strong. Yeah. And you know, industrial recruiters like the idea that if there's a piece of land that the people don't want to sell, they can go to the government and get the government to make the people sell it to them. You know, the government comes in, buys it, and then sells it back to a private company to build a plant or to build a store or to build something on. And that's one of the reasons we haven't been able to get a eminent domain amendment on the North Carolina Constitution. Hopefully in the future, we may be able to get that so that the only taking of property can be for a legitimate public use.
I think the first bill filed in the 2015 long session was House Bill 2, which was eminent domain, and it didn't make it out of the General Assembly. Well, Francis DeLuca, thank you very much for enlightening us on this topic. It's been very educational. We appreciate you, as always, being our guest here today on What Matters in North Carolina.
Thank you, Mark, and great topic.
I really enjoy talking about things that are really foundational to conservatism. And wanted to replay that segment for you because it's the kind of thing that we need to hear more than once. As conservatives, we need to be reminded of how important things like property rights are and free markets and capitalism. In fact, coming up on Monday's show, we have a great, great program just for you to understand why free markets are important, why capitalism is important. And you've been hearing me talk a lot lately, I guess kind of prompted by a panel I was on a few weeks ago talking about what does it mean to be a conservative these days. We believe in people. We want to lift people up. We want people to be all that they can be. We want them to achieve. We want them to keep more of their hard-earned money. We want them to dream and have an opportunity to live that dream, to be an entrepreneur if they want to. And so let's get government out of the way. Let's get regulations that are onerous and unnecessary out of the way. And let's lower taxes and let's encourage people. That's what conservatism is all about. That's what free markets and capitalism is all about. And property rights is often said, and I agree with this, and talking to Francis just now just reinforced that you really can't have liberty without the ability to own property without fear that the government or somebody else is going to come along and take it away. So always a great reminder, and we appreciate Francis DeLuca of the Civitas Institute for his great insight on a very important topic for you and me and others who are trying to learn more and understand what it means to be a conservative. We've had a phenomenal week, really. We've talked a lot about Charlotte. We've talked a lot about some of the issues facing the African-American community and some of the challenges that could be addressed if we could just get the race-baiting, hate-stirring folks to stop that and really begin constructive dialogue. I think that would be just tremendous. And there are folks that want to do that. And yet there are also folks that want to stir the pot. And unfortunately, that's what the media loves. So anyway, have a great weekend, folks. Thank you so much for listening to What Matters in North Carolina. My name is Mark Shiver, and I will look forward to speaking with you again Monday.